What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to another episode of Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I'm one of your hosts, King Cash, joined by, as always, by my good friend and the one, the great, JVZ.
Thank you, Kaz.
What's up, man?
I got kind of a stick up my butt.
Okay. What's going on?
It's just we've had a lot of I feel like this is like the safety weekend of sports. Just like every so often you kind of get reminded that some of these things that we watch are kind of dangerous. And this weekend especially, I think what first got me thinking about it was I was watching the big boxing event this weekend, which was the Mike Tyson Roy Jones fight, which I think when we first talked about it on this show, I think we were a little bit worried that a couple of these guys were getting a little up there in age and this might not be so safe for them. And turns out that wasn't as big a deal. Both those guys know how to protect themselves. But on the undercard was Jake Paul, who had one fight going into this, which he did win, and he's been training for a while, but he was fighting Nate Robinson. That's NBA, former NBA player, Nate Robinson, who had no experience whatsoever. He was basically training for a couple months leading up to this fight.
Yeah.
And then I think the training difference was pretty easy to see. Basically, Robinson got knocked the fuck out in the second round after, I think, the third knockdown. And he looked like he was pretty much unconscious after on the knockout blow. I think like the response to this, while some of it was kind of funny and some of it was clowning him and stuff, but I think part of it just made me feel like, okay, this is not a thing that anybody can just step in and do. Nate Robinson is like an athlete. He is more fit than 99% of us out there who talk shit about sports all the time. And we say dumb shit like, oh, we could do that. Or, even for things like, you know, skilled things like basketball or baseball or, you know, pitching or whatever. And we talk like we can do that stuff. But, boxing is probably one of the hardest out of anything that you could try to step in and do. It's
any most dangerous, combat fighting sport. It's really dangerous, right? Because it's not a street fight, right? It's not you fighting some guy at the mall. You have the ability to swing as hard as you want because your hands are protected, right? You don't have to worry about your hands getting hurt or those kind of things or shit like that, right? The biggest thing is, and I think a lot of people don't understand this, right? Because you made the point of the fly-by-night sports fans who talk shit and say, oh, I could do that, I could do this, I could do that. But sometimes that goes both ways, right? It even goes both ways in the professional sense, because there have been a lot of these big-time failures of people going from one type of sport to another and it not translating super duper well, right? Nate Robinson is a basketball player. He's built his whole life around being a basketball player. His physical body is tuned to being a basketball player. While it might be tuned to him bumping into people or all these kind of things, and he might have gotten into like some kind of scraps as a basketball player, that's totally different than and I understand for most people, they're going to look at it, they're going to be like, oh, Jake Paul's a YouTuber. Like, yeah, but he's been training.
He's a YouTuber who trained for 2 years. Yeah.
He's been training. And even before that, right? Because it was like a hobby of his to train that way, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who just like the idea of training combat, right? As a style of working out, as a style of to keep yourself fit and things like that. So those things are just totally different those are totally different things, and people of all walks of life, fly-by-night fans and professional people, do this shit a little too often sometimes, where they're like, oh, I can do that, right? And sometimes we give, I think, athletes too much credit when they say these things, right? Because now this is having a whole host of other basketball players who are like, oh, I could fucking do that, you know, or football players who are saying that now. And it's like, yeah, you're big, you're athletic, but your body is tuned to something else.
Like even if you look at the tail of the tape, I mean, Nate Robinson is, like, when we say basketball player, for those unfamiliar with Nate Robinson basically made a name out of being one of the shortest players in the NBA, oftentimes the shortest player in the league, but he was incredibly athletic. He could dunk at 5'9", which, I mean, that's like our height. But for an NBA player, that's on the short, if not the shortest end of the spectrum. But, you know, I think Jake Paul is like 6'1". He had a reach advantage. He had a height advantage. I think their weight was roughly similar. And then he had an experience advantage. But, you know, we still had people saying, and myself included, thinking like, oh, well, I mean, Nate Robinson's an athlete. Jake Paul is a YouTuber. And just no, like he's been doing this for 2 years. That matters. And you know, Nate Robinson's just been doing this for a little bit. And just from the perspective of even being trained in order to protect yourself, which is the most important thing in boxing, is to protect yourself at all times. And Nate Robinson was not able to do that. And Jake Paul made quick work of him. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it seems like Paul is forming. I mean, he seems like he's serious about this, and he is enjoying parlaying his personality as a hated YouTuber and turning that into money as people pay to watch him hopefully get knocked out. But he's actually experienced and he's actually serious about doing this. So, you know, more power to anybody who wants to put in the effort to do this. And I mean, respect to Nate Robinson for even trying this, but it's also just not that simple. That's something you can just kind of step into. I was thinking,
we've even seen fighters, right? We've seen people who have done it from similar sports. And I think this is a thing that I want to start to break down for people some way, somehow, right? We've seen wrestlers go into MMA, yeah, right? Like professional wrestlers, and people have this disconnect because they go, oh, they're just steroided people doing ballet, right? Where it's like, no, they're still training in a combat sport. They're still training in a discipline of grappling and all these kind of things that translates. Now, while parts of their fights might be scripted, it's still a lot of slamming your body on the ground and having somebody else grapple you and toss you around and do all these things, which tunes your body still to grappling. They spend, you know, let's say 90% of their time sparring. So that's why that translation makes sense for professional wrestlers to go into MMA. And that's why some of them tend to do rather well, because you're coming across these people who are not masters in any discipline, where, you know, wrestlers are generally tend to be good grapplers. So, you know, these things just kind of tend to happen that way, where like people just think, oh, because you're athletic, you can do athletic things. And it's not a blank ticket. It doesn't just mean you get to check it in. I mean, we could go into Michael Jordan trying to play baseball, right? Like, yeah, is he a decent baseball player? Sure. Is he probably going to beat me in a pickup game of baseball? Sure. Yeah. But was he like in retrospect, was he ever actually going to beat professional baseball players? No, because nothing about his skills.
If you were to believe The Last Dance, if you could give him a couple more years, then he would have done it. But I mean, he reached the double A level, which I think, not knowing as much about minor league baseball, I didn't realize until I actually started playing out of the park baseball that that's like five levels up from the entry level. Mm-hmm. And so like he reached that level pretty quickly, yeah. Even though he was bad there, but he was getting better at that level. So yeah, it's, you know, and then you got two sport athletes like, you know, Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders. And
but see, some people like that are few and far between.
Yes.
And like there are, like, we think about it and people talk about it and people try to make it seem like it wasn't crazy, but what those two did to be exceptional at two sports, like exceptional at two sports professionally, was really, really astounding.
Yeah. And like, those are games of, like, I would call them sports of skill. They're not sports where you have somebody trying to hit you in the face. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I feel like that's just a whole different animal. So like, just even the fact that Jake Paul had one fight under his belt is a huge advantage over somebody who has never had another fight under their belt before. Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, sparring at the gym is different. And just the fact that, you know, you send somebody out there and you've been hit in the face before, you know what that's like, and you know the endurance and all of that other stuff that you have to deal with in over the course of a fight. I think that's a huge deal, and that's a huge advantage. I've like, going into this event, I was like, mm-hmm. oh, maybe they should make celebrity boxing more of a thing, because I feel like people would tune into that kind of stuff more often. And then after that fight, I realized, like, maybe that's not the safest thing to do. Like, maybe everybody's first fight should be behind closed doors, so that when they get knocked out, like, there aren't memes of them, you know, floating everywhere around the internet, yeah, like there were for Nate Robinson right after this fight.
That circles back around to the, like, people's disconnect of, like, oh, he's an athlete, he should have won, he's fighting a YouTuber. Like, it's the weird disconnect that happens. Yeah. So it's dumb. All right,
Jake Paul's gonna get rich off of that disconnect, though.
Well, so. yeah, no, it's gonna be a thing. Like, and he's gonna have more people that want to challenge him. And the thing is, right, he'll never actually have to, like, box another boxer, right? He could just keep fighting athletes from other sports who want to prove their worth. And he's going to always be a boxer, right? And he's only going to get better at boxing, where these people are going to be coming from something else to this. And it's like, it's great snake oil. You know what I mean? Like, he really did it.
He did call out Conor McGregor, who does have one fight under his belt. And he also called out his brother, so... who also has a couple fights under his belt. So,
but see, those are people that I think, unless he actually fights another combat sport person and beats them, I don't think those people pay him any mind, right? Because those people see it for what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Like, if he calls out a fighter who's definitely looking for a step up, right, and the eyes can give you the step up, like getting eyes on you will give you that step up, then definitely somebody will go at him. But somebody like Conor McGregor or somebody in kind of the prime or twilight of their career is not going to pay him any mind.
Yeah,
because it's not worthwhile for them to pay him any mind, right? Like that's where you have to kind of nickel and dime, right? For Conor McGregor to take that fight, he gains nothing, right? He might get a good check out of it, but it does nothing for his legacy to say that he beat Jake Paul, you know? So, and he doesn't have to do that at this point in his career. So it's one of those things. You got to find the right person at the right time kind of thing, which I don't think is.
Didn't really need to take this fight were Mike Tyson and Roy Jones. I think Roy Jones was definitely in there for the paycheck.
Yeah, so like
Mike Tyson seemed to be out there looking to prove something.
Let's talk about the build up of this and then the kind of the finish of it, right? So this started as kind of like this fun exhibition thing between like two really great boxers of their time, kind of trying to shine the light again on boxing, which has kind of been dimming a little bit. And then it kind of became this thing where it was like, yeah, this is great. This is cool. Like, and people get to talk about these two great fighters again, in the mythos of boxing and in the current realm. And then that led to everybody watching them train, right? And the first little bit, you're like, holy shit, they both still have it, right? You see the videos of Roy Jones Jr. training, and he's looking good. You see the videos of Mike Tyson training, and he's looking good. But then you start seeing more and more and more videos of Mike Tyson training, and he's getting, like, fit, which a lot of people have gotten into the steroids talk, and I'm not going to do it here again this time. I've talked about that a lot. But at a certain point, Mike Tyson looked, I mean, in this fight, really fit.
Like, he looked dangerous, and he looked like he could go a couple more rounds. He looked like Mike Tyson. I don't want to say prime Mike Tyson, but, you know, he definitely looked.
So there were these moments, right? It starts out kind of slow, and they're respecting each other, and you have these moments, and then I think they get to this moment where they kind of start hitting each other, right? Like, Roy lands a couple good punches, Mike lands a couple good punches, and then Mike Tyson kind of turns into Mike Tyson, right? And he's, like, chasing Roy Jones down, like, in that, like, Mike Tyson way, just kind of bobbing and weaving and just coming at you. And that's where I kind of started to get a little bit worried that, like, because I think, like, right up until the point of coming into this, there was a, like, a really quiet moment where everybody was like, is Mike still crazy? Like, because there is a lot of being like, oh, you know, it's going to be a fun little thing, it's going to whatever. And then, you know, after all these videos of Mike Tyson looking like really prime Mike Tyson, hitting bags and stuff, people were like, what happens if Mike just goes for it? Like, we all know it's bad, a like, thing.
And as DJ points out, like, you know, Roy Jones was kind of a counterpuncher in his day. You know, he liked to dance a lot and make people look silly. And after a while, it seemed like Mike Tyson was kind of taking offense to that and taking offense to having to chase Roy Jones Jr. around the ring. You know, because, I mean, he made it pretty clear, like, he wants to do this for charity and he wants to keep doing this. But, you know, it's not entertaining if the fighters have to chase each other and they're not actually boxing and they're not throwing punches. And Mike Tyson was trying to throw punches and Roy Jones was trying more to not get hit by those punches than he was to, you know, throw those punches
and then
himself.
As the fight went on, guys, as the fight went on, you could really see Roy Jones holding and clinching a lot.
Yeah.
He did not want to mix it up with Mike. Either he was winded in the later rounds, or he just knew that Mike was coming for that action, and he just wanted none of it.
Yeah, which is the thing I think everyone got worried about.
I mean, I don't know if I was necessarily worried at that point, because I think at that point I could see that, like, both fighters were capable of defending themselves, and like, neither one of them was going to kill the other one at that point. And so I think part of that was just seeing the fight before that and seeing, like, you know, the difference in their ability to defend themselves. But yeah, I think that was, you know, like, we definitely saw flashes of the old Mike Tyson. And I think, you know, enough that people are going to be pretty excited for the next one. And you can keep doing these bouts for charity. And also, I think people are not going to feel like he's severely risking his health by continuing to do this, you know, even though he's in his 50s. Roy Jones Jr. has been out of boxing for 3 years, and Tyson's been out for 15, but Tyson definitely looked like he was the fresher one. And he very clearly took this seriously. Like you said, to the point where you know, where we thought he was turning into the crazy Mike Tyson of old, and not the more reformed, chiller Mike Tyson that we've seen in recent years publicly. I guess what some people like to call Hangover Mike Tyson, basically his persona since he was in the Hangover movies. So I don't know. I think hopefully this will be good for boxing. It's kind of sad that boxing has to do this kind of stuff, but
yeah. I do want to talk a little bit about the decision, because JVZ, oh, yeah. you made a great point about how boxing, I love the sport personally, and I loved seeing people talk about boxing again, because I love the sport. I genuinely enjoy it. I watch top-ranked boxing on ESPN as often as I get. I follow guys, Bud Crawford, Teofimo Lopez. I dig boxing. I always have. Yep. But then this exhibition between Mike Tyson and Roy Jones, it got eyes on boxing again for one night, which was really cool. And then boxing did what boxing always does. And as I tweeted, and JVZ replied, boxing once again shot itself in the dick, because it went to the scorecards after 8 rounds, and in a fight that was clearly, clearly in favor of Mike Tyson, the judges ruled it a draw. And that right there was just like all of the things about modern boxing that people just get so frustrated with, in that they're prize fighters and there is money in the rematch, and the judges decided that this was a draw when it was clearly not. And I didn't love the fight personally. I thought it was pretty uninspired. Like, I know it was an exhibition, but still, I wasted looking for it on the internet. Yeah, I wasn't going to pay for that, but I wasted bandwidth on it.
And that was if it's for charity, I'll donate to the charity.
And yeah, this was the good and the bad of boxing right here. And boxing shot itself in the dick once again.
Yeah. If there is any sport that can do with somebody coming in and actually trying to unify everything and you know, under one single governing body, and and dictate who fights who, and make sure that people don't have to wait for those matchups. And as much as we might give the UFC shit for certain things, like people get to see the fights they want to see. The judging, there's always going to be controversy, but for the most part, I think whenever there's a clear winner, usually that's how the decision plays out. I feel like there's fewer shenanigans, and boxing has been notorious for shenanigans and over so many years. So it's, I don't know, but glad to see people talking about boxing, and I hope people learn to respect it, respect the amount of skill that goes into it, the craft, how hard it is, how grueling it is from an endurance perspective. And we got to see two Hall of Famers go at it and two newbies go at it right after each other. So you kind of see like the wide breadth of difference there. So that's one of the safety sports that I wanted to talk about. The other one is F1, because we had a really bad crash this weekend. I think one of the worst that some people have seen in their lifetime from what I've read over the internet. Romain Grosjean on the first lap hit a barrier kind of diagonally. And then immediately his car exploded, which is not supposed to happen. Especially since these are hybrid cars, but I think it was like the fuel tank and the fuel cells like ruptured in half because his car split in half. Racing is also another one of those sports where like people, they're driving a car. So it seems like, and when you watch it on TV, it doesn't seem like they're going that fast. But this car was going like 250 kilometers an hour, which I don't know what that is in miles per hour.
It's like 120, 130-ish, yeah, like I think.
Or something. But yeah, I think it was like a 500G impact. To the point where like the car was shredded. Everything except for the cockpit of the car was demolished. But the cockpit was wedged in the barrier to the point where the safety structure that is meant to protect their heads, which they call the halo, is like that was completely intact. To the point where like Grosjean like had that much of an impact, but he himself was intact and he was able to climb out of this car in the middle of a giant fire. So it kind of just speaks to the amount of thought that's gone into the safety aspect of the sport. Just the fact that like they had the idea of the first lap, there's always, you know, crashes and stuff. So to have like a medical car follow everybody on the first lap. And so, you know, that crash happened and then the medical car was there within like 5 seconds. And they were there to help him out and, you know, spray him down with the, you know, it help extinguish the fire as he was getting out of the car. So, it's just another one of those reminders of A, how difficult the sport is, B, how much thought goes into safety, and C, like, you know, just how anybody can die in the sport just at any moment. But thankfully, like the halo itself, I think when it was first introduced a couple of years ago, a lot of people claimed that it was ugly, it was controversial. And then now we've had a couple high profile accidents where the halo very clearly saved the driver's life. In this case, it like the barrier would have decapitated Grosjean if it wasn't for the halo, which was completely intact. And like that thing did its job exactly the way it was intended to. And you know, shout out to everybody who didn't listen to the criticism it's a sport with a long history of deaths.
And that's the thing when we get into talking about safety, right? You have these people who are very well paid to look at a problem, see a problem, think about how that problem further impacts their sport, and then how to fix it, right? And then what's the best way to fix that? What's the most cost-efficient way to fix that? Okay, if we can't be cost-efficient, how do we make sure that it's standardized? How do we do all these things, right? And they do it, and they do it well, especially for most motorsports, right? Because we've gotten to a point where a lot of these sports were really, really dangerous, and they still are, but there are a lot more precautions that people sometimes may not understand, like with the limiters and things like that were put on stock cars in NASCAR or the halo, like you're talking about, right? Where fans might talk about these things as being like, oh, they ruin the sport or they ruin the integrity of things. No, it's adding safety to these things. It's keeping these people alive so that they can continue to do this thing a lot longer and take care of their families and not just be here to entertain you as though this is some gladiatory combat where you know, death is always an option. No, like we want to, as much as we can, take death off of the table, right? And that accident has so many scenarios in it that could end in that driver's death. And it doesn't because of that engineering, because of that thought prevention, to have the halo, to have all these things, to have this, like you said, the safety car there, to like the way the racing suits are designed, right? To repel flames and to a certain extent, in case the car catches on fire, then the car is designed to not catch on fire in most scenarios, right? Like, but you still have this race suit that is meant to prevent fire, right? Because you can go, oh, well, the cars aren't supposed to catch on fire anymore. We don't need these super, like, you know, hot race suits, because that's the other thing is they do trap a lot of your body heat, but it's like, heavy. Yeah, And it's like, oh, well, we don't need those anymore. We could create super lightweight ones because the cars don't catch fire anymore. No, keep it because it is a precaution that will save lives on the off chance that the car does catch fire, which is what happened in this situation, right? And we've had those situations in the past where in F1 and in NASCAR where the cars catch fire and they have these super lightweight suits that then fuse to their body and they have to go through years and hours of surgery to you know, remove those things and do skin grafts and all these kind of things. And, you know, the worst of his injuries were the burns, hands, and cuts and bruises.
And I think his suit would have been able to withstand 30 seconds of that fire, and he was in it for like 20 of it, so... Yeah, like the suit definitely helped save his life. He was able to, a couple things went wrong, but so many things went right here. Even like, I'm glad you mentioned that, like, fires are kind of rare now, like, and there's a reason why they don't do refueling anymore in F1. You can go find videos of refueling disasters. But yeah, like, fires are so uncommon now, and that's just a testament to how much they have tried to make the sport more safe. So, the crashes are happening just as often, the mistakes are happening just as often, but the deaths are happening a lot less often. And the serious injuries are happening a lot less often. We're seeing crashes like this and crashes like the Ryan Newman one that we talked about before for NASCAR, where, like, it's just amazing that somebody walked out of that. It's engineering excellence, I have to say. So, all right, let's move on to a story that I completely forgot to include last week. So that's my bad. Kim Ng has been hired by the Miami Marlins to be their general manager. So she's making history as the first woman to basically run a baseball team as the general manager. I think the second woman all time to get a general manager job in any major men's sport. Also breaking barriers as an Asian American as well. And as a person of East Asian descent. She has been basically, her career started as an intern with the White Sox in 1990. And I think around the late 90s, that's when she started applying for general manager positions. She was an assistant GM for the Yankees and the Dodgers. And she's basically spent the last 15 years trying to get a general manager position. Despite her many, many years of experience doing the assistant job and also working in the league office and making contacts around there. So this might be one of the most overqualified people to ever get a chance to work one of these jobs. And so now she'll be working under Derek Jeter and the rest of the Marlins ownership. I think she had a chance to work with him when he was a player with the Yankees, so I think that familiarity helped. This is kind of one of those long overdue hires when you, like, everybody talks about the breaking of barriers, but then you interview everybody else that she's ever worked with, and they all say, yeah, she should have gotten this job, like, you know, 5-10 years ago. So the Marlins are kind of, I would say they're kind of on the up and up. Under new ownership, made the playoffs this year, kind of scared everybody. She's got still a pretty steep task to try to rebuild that roster, but hopefully she does well. And this leads to more opportunities for women and other minorities in men's sports.
Definitely.
Sarah Fuller is a name that's probably been on people's radar this weekend for being the first woman to play in a Power 5 college football game. She basically got to, she had one kick, basically. She was the kicker for the game. And unfortunately for Vanderbilt, Vanderbilt didn't score. So that basically didn't give her the chance to do anything. other than kickoff for the second half. But just even that kick made history. So, you know, had Vanderbilt scored a touchdown, she probably would have been able to kick an extra point. If they had made it far enough for a field goal, she probably would have been able to kick that, but they didn't. They lost 41-0. They've had a very, very rough season to the point where Coach Derek Mason has been fired. Yeah, they're 0-8 this year in the SEC, I believe. So tough conference, but yeah, not the greatest showing for the team. But at least this is a silver lining to all that. Fuller normally plays goalkeeper for the Vanderbilt soccer team, so I think this was kind of one of those crossover moves that makes sense, like you were talking about before. So
yeah,
dual sport athlete.
A lot of kickers tend to come from soccer, and other schools have done this with male athletes before, getting somebody from the soccer program.
Okay, so DGM mentions that she was the goalie, but the goalie is supposed to take goal kicks, and so generally the goalies actually have the strongest legs. Maybe not necessarily the strongest, but they're part of their job is to take the ball way in the back and kick it deep to the other side of the field. So it makes being able to do that with strength and accuracy is a big part of the job of being a goalkeeper. So it does make sense that that they would pick her, and that they would kind of target the goalkeepers as a place to draw that talent from. I also found out Vanderbilt doesn't have a men's soccer team, I believe. So, so I think that was part of all this too. So, good for her. I think there's been other women that have been able to kick for college football teams, but this is the first time it's happened for a Power Five team. So, so a little bit of history, one step at a time. All right, now let's move on to some historically bad stuff with the NFL and more COVID shenanigans. The Patriots have been fined, the Saints have been fined, and Dr. Draft Pick for repeated offenses. The Steelers-Ravens game has been moved. It was originally scheduled for Thanksgiving Day. It's been moved multiple times to the point where it got moved again today. Today's Monday. It was scheduled for Tuesday. Tomorrow, it has now been moved to Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern, I think. Because they don't want it to conflict with the game's supposed to be on NBC, and NBC had scheduled the Rockefeller Plaza tree lighting ceremony for prime time. So football doesn't get the prime time slot. They get the slot before then. And I think the count right now is at 11 Ravens players and 8 staffers, but I think it's probably gone up since I last checked. So they're having their own outbreak to deal with. I think this is the deepest that a game has been, or the latest that a game has been postponed. We've had, Thursday games postponed to Sunday, and then, Sunday games postponed to Tuesday. But, it's the first one that's been postponed this many days, because just each day that passes by, there seems to be another positive test. So we'll see whether this game even gets played this, quote-unquote, week.
Who knows?
I think everybody is prepared accordingly, fantasy-wise. But, yeah.
I mean, that was the, just for the watching fans and for the fantasy football fans, right? That was kind of the big takeaway going into the season, that it wasn't going to be what you expected, right? Not only were you going to have to deal with injuries and other things, you were going to have to deal with COVID protocol and whether or not teams were going to follow it correctly or not, and that was one of the big things we talked about. And now we're here. Due to that situation, a lot of these teams are not taking the proper safety precautions going into these things, and we're constantly having more and more and more outbreaks, and we're having people lie about outbreaks or lie about the spread in their facilities to keep playing games and essentially keep making money. So it's like, And it's hard because it's not just the teams and the organizations. There's a part of it that's on the players too, but it's definitely on the teams and organizations to put across how much, you know, this means. But it's probably also a lot of these players trying to secure their player incentives and trying to, you know, secure these things that are in their contracts so that they can make the most amount of dollars that they can. So it's a really, really tough situation all around.
Yeah. And it's not even contained to the teams, and it's sometimes it's just everybody else ruining it too. Like, you know, in the case of Santa Clara County, there's a huge spike. So the government decided, like no sports for the next 3 weeks. And that includes the 49ers, and it includes Stanford football and San Jose State football, and even San Jose Sharks training camp. Like, they can't do anything until December 21st. And the Niners have two home games during that period. So they have to go figure out somewhere else to play. And apparently they've struck a deal with the Arizona Cardinals where they can go play in Arizona for their two scheduled home games on December 7th and December 13th. But, you know, this was, you know, the team hasn't necessarily been, you know, the cleanest when it comes to their, you know, when it comes to players catching COVID. But I think they never really hit outbreak status, but because the area around them hit outbreak status, they have to deal with not being able to play home games. So it's, you know, just one other strange effect of all this. But I think probably the weirdest one all season was what happened to the Broncos this weekend, where they lost all of their quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, if you think about it, it kind of makes sense because, you know, the quarterbacks meet together, they practice together. Yeah, that's quarterback Jeff Driscoll tested positive, and because all the other quarterbacks were in close proximity to him, that made it so none of them could play this weekend. The Broncos found out about this late Saturday night, on Saturday after they had their final practice. So basically they had game planned everything, practiced everything, and then they found out like none of their quarterbacks can play, or none of the players who play the most important position on the field can play. So they had to elevate wide receiver Kendall Hinton from the practice squad, who I think last played quarterback a couple years ago for his college team. They had to elevate him to starting quarterback, and then kind of redesign the playbook overnight to be kind of a more run heavy playbook. He only ended up throwing 9 passes in the game, completed one of them, which good for him, but completed one to his own team, completed 2 to the other team. But that one pass went for 13 yards. The Broncos lost 31-3. So, kind of one of those like really tough situations for them to deal with. And just effectively a throwaway game at that point. So the NFL is really concerned that the Thanksgiving weekend is going to lead to a huge spike in cases. So aside from the games that they have scheduled today, tomorrow, basically aside from those postponed games, they have suspended all team activities for November 30th and December 1st. So basically the Monday and Tuesday after Thanksgiving weekend, just nobody is allowed to meet. Nobody is allowed to come in contact with each other. Just with the hope that if anybody caught COVID over the weekend, at least they're not going to give it to each other for a couple days. And they're going to hope that that is enough to just calm everybody down. But we'll see how well it works. I don't believe that any of this is going to jeopardize the season overall, because they're just going to keep playing and keep trying to make as much money as they can no matter what.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just seems to be getting worse and worse. And each week we talk about this, and each week we've got another story of either a team not taking it seriously or a team taking it seriously and things going bad anyways, or it's just been a big mess. And as much praise as the NBA got for their bubble, they're going to be in the middle of this mess as well when their season resumes in a couple weeks. So it's going to be just as bad.
Yeah. I mean, there just needs to be a standard protocol going across the board, right? I think one of the big problems, especially for the NFL, was the let's pretend like it doesn't exist. Some people think did, you know, where it's like, oh, we can still have fans in the stands, so let's have more fans in the stands, right? Because it's all about that nickel and dime, right? And everybody will start with the best of intentions in the NBA, and they'll be like, oh, you know what, no fans in the stand. And then there's going to be one team who's just like, yeah, but we want that money. Yeah. So it's like, we'll have fans. We need to have fans in the stand. If we have to have fans in the stand, that means we have to have, you know, more security officers. Well, you know, if fans are going to be here, we might as well open up the concession stands, take in food deliveries, and all these other things that break all of that protocol. No matter how safe you think you can be, all of those things instantly break that protocol, right? Because now you have so many points of failure that just exist outside of the players, trainers, and coaches, you know, and necessary staff. You put yourself in such that position. It's just, there's no way that you can vouch for every, like, you can hardly vouch for most of the players in the NFL and the NBA, right?
Yeah,
like,
no, you can't. It's
so you're adding most of them are dumb factors. It's just, no, it's bad math. It's just bad math.
Yeah. And, I just on a personal note, I did get an email from the Kings as far as being a season ticket holder this upcoming year. They basically said my the amount of money that I've continued to pay into it has been moved to the year after this upcoming season. So it looks like they're not planning to have any fans in the stands for now, and they're at least handling it properly from a season ticket holder perspective. And they're not gonna try to force it. So I'm glad about that, at least, because I wasn't gonna be going to any games.
Yeah.
That made me a little happy. One thing that probably made DJM and other people in the Detroit area pretty happy this week was Matt Patricia and Bob Quinn for the Detroit Lions getting fired finally. After a pretty bad loss to the Texans on Thanksgiving Day, the Texans, who had their own exorcism when Bill O'Brien got fired earlier this year. So I think Matt Patricia was on our hot seat. This has kind of been a long time coming.
He was on the hot seat last year, guys.
Yeah.
After it was made official, pretty much the entirety of the Detroit Lions media corps, the Lions beat writers, came out with columns essentially telling that Matt Patricia's run as Detroit Lions head coach was doomed almost from the start. He developed a less than great relationship with players in his first training camp. There was the indictment he was brought up on sexual assault charges back like 20 years ago, but never actually brought to court for. And just on top of that, general manager Bob Quinn, who he and Patricia tried to implement the Patriot way in Detroit, and just the general idea that Matt Patricia was going to try and take what was a 9-7 trending upward team, and instead of building on that, which was put together by Jim Caldwell, he and Bob Quinn took the option of telling all of these guys that they're fucking garbage and everything had to be built from the ground up. And that was really the only way to really win football. And it ended up making the Detroit Lions look like a bottom five team in the league all over again. So he was fired unceremoniously on Saturday, along with Bob Quinn, who had been the general manager for 5 years. His drafting was average to below average. His player signings in free agency were mostly bad. And now it's looking like what many people see as his best draft pick, wide receiver Kenny Golladay, who has emerged as a really talented receiver, is probably going to leave the Detroit Lions in free agency because Bob Quinn came from the Patriots system where they often don't sign star players long term because everybody just does their job and it's all a machine that just keeps running. Except that's not how the rest of the NFL works. When you have a Sith Lord as your head coach, yeah, that might work. And also it should be pointed out, in the last couple of years that Matt Patricia was the defensive coordinator in New England, their defense wasn't exactly setting the world on fire, so make of that what you will. It's unfortunate because the Detroit Lions are in so much worse shape now than when Jim Caldwell was fired. They're in so much worse shape. They had the opportunity with the third overall pick to maybe draft a quarterback or maybe do something to bolster their defense with a lineman or a linebacker, because the linebacker core of the Detroit Lions is among the league worst. But they took Jeffrey Okuda, who in his rookie year as a cornerback has not exactly been Patrick Peterson, we'll say. Again, he's a rookie. Darius Slay, who the Lions drafted, had the same problems in his rookie season, so that remains to be seen. Still, they took a cornerback with a third overall pick. Make of that what you will. Yeah, just everything. They left the Detroit Lions in so much worse shape. And now, today, as we're recording this on Monday, now it's finally looking like Matthew Stafford, the veteran quarterback, is now the question of what is his future going to be with the Detroit Lions. Is he going to deal with yet another new head coach, possibly another offensive coordinator who will take the place of Daryl Bevel, who's now the interim head coach? And he's been in the league 12 years. Everyone knows he's a talented, good quarterback who can show flashes of greatness now and then. If he were on a team that wasn't the worst franchise in pro sports, yeah, he would probably be amongst the elite quarterbacks in the league. Unfortunately, Matthew Stafford, he got drafted number one overall by the Detroit Lions right after their 0-16 season. And he would have to be, as I've said on this podcast before, you would have to be the second coming of Johnny Unitas to pull the Detroit Lions out of what they are. Matthew Stafford is a good quarterback, and if he goes to another team, he will pull your team to the playoffs. He will be that element. I don't know if wins above replacement is a thing in football, but generally Matthew Stafford's wins above replacement year to year is generally gauged around 4-6. So, yeah, if you're looking for a quarterback in the next year or two when his contract is up, yeah. But this further proves my conspiracy that Bill Belichick is a Dark Lord of the Sith, and he sends his apprentices, his minions, his former assistant coaches, who I will not include Mike Vrabel for Tennessee, because he was not an assistant. He only played for Belichick.
He was just a player. Yeah.
Yep. He sends his assistant coaches out to destroy other franchises. And then sometimes they come back, like Josh McDaniels, and then sometimes they don't. But, yeah, I believe that this is all a part of Darth Belichick's plan. And he put the Detroit Lions, who were trending upward, in the basement all over again. And, yeah, this is a nightmare. Like, the reason I watch other teams in the league and across the league, the reason I'm a more knowledgeable football fan, is that I cannot be focused on just my team, because the Detroit Lions are the worst franchise in sports. They are not a team to root for. They are not a team to take seriously. They are the ultimate hottest of trash. Credit to Sheila Ford Hamp. She does not have the same loyalty as her father, William Clay Ford. She got rid of the guys when they proved to be a national embarrassment on Thanksgiving. Also, big shout out to the Houston Texans and Deshaun Watson, so much so that Detroit Lions fans began donating to Deshaun Watson's charity, the Deshaun Watson Foundation. I myself donated $10. Lots of fans were donating $13 individually for each of Matt Patricia's wins in his 3 years as Detroit Lions head coach. Average that out, folks, and you'll get an idea of how good a coach he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. This just, I can't even bring myself to yell and scream about the Lions because they're the worst franchise in sports. I don't take them seriously. There's nothing to look forward to now. Matthew Stafford is likely going to be gone, and God knows what else is going to happen. It's just an unending vortex of suck with the Detroit Lions. And I feel like the city of Detroit, Southeast Michigan, and the state of Michigan as a whole should get the NFL Sunday ticket for free. Or discount. so we can watch other football teams instead of this one. We should get a discount. We should be able to show our name and our zip code to our cable providers and to the NFL and say, hey, I live in Michigan. And there should be, okay. We will cut the Sunday ticket price by 60% for you because it's been 60 years since the Lions won a goddamn thing. We'll cut that for you. We'll cut that for you. And you're good. Enjoy the Sunday ticket. Thoughts and prayers to you. And maybe somewhere down the line, maybe if the Fords sell the team, maybe. Who knows? And, you know, I don't want to say what I'm about to say. Maybe, just maybe, over six decades of gross incompetence, maybe the league could pull a Donald Sterling with the Ford family and the Lions and just pull them the fuck away. Maybe.
All right, so I have to make you look a little bit forward. And I don't know who. I guess they're going to bring in a new general manager at some point. Mm-hmm. Those names aren't necessarily ones that we know off the top of our heads, but you know, we know some head coach names.
Permission to geek out a little bit?
All right.
Okay, because I was looking a little bit into the general manager names because that would give me some insight into what they might be looking for as a coach. And my main criteria for a general manager would be someone that knows how to draft in the later rounds. Because that was one of, actually, it was something that Martin Mayhew did better than Bob Quinn, and it was in the third, fourth, fifth rounds. And I was looking around, and there were a couple of guys that really stood out to me. One was Ed Dodds, who was the assistant GM with the Indianapolis Colts right now, and he also worked in the Seahawks organization. He worked in Seattle. And they have a good draft history. And as does Seattle, which leads me to Scott Fitterer, who is one of the directors of player personnel with the Seattle Seahawks. He's a guy that I've heard and I've read that he is interested in looking for a general manager job. And also on my list of potential GMs is a guy by the name of Joe Horitz. And he is the director of player personnel for the Baltimore Ravens, which means, ding dong, he's an Ozzie Newsome guy. And that immediately got my attention. And yeah. If I'm Sheila Fort Hamp, I am calling Ozzie Newsome's agent and I'm saying, what would it take to bring you in just as a consultant? Not even for the full-time general manager job, just to be our football guy. Because Rod Wood, the president of the Detroit Lions organization, he's not a football guy. He's a business guy. He works with the Fords. He handles the Ford businesses, the family estates, all of that stuff. But to bring in a football guy to be their consultant, I would call Ozzie Newsome and just say, name your price. Help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You are our only hope. And if it's Joe Horitz, I'd be down with that. I'm looking at people in player personnel in Seattle, and I'm looking in Baltimore. And I like what the New Orleans Saints are doing, too. They seem to know how to find talent, and that's what you need as a general manager and a scouting department. On the coaching side of things, I'm going to say something that might be mildly controversial. Eric Bieniemy, the offensive coordinator for the Kansas City Chiefs, I'm not exactly hot on him, and I'll say a few reasons why. Eric Bieniemy is the offensive coordinator for the Kansas City Chiefs. He was also their running backs coach before getting promoted to offensive coordinator. The thing is, I ask myself, how much of his success is him as the play caller, and how much of it is Andy Reid, who, as we know, is an offensive-minded coach. He does the play calling, a lot of it, with Eric Bieniemy, and it is Andy Reid's offense. And number two, he's calling plays for Patrick Mahomes, who we can see can pretty much do anything. How would he do with this organization that does not have the same level of talent around? For a coach, I'm looking for a guy that would know how to do more with less. And I am not seeing that with Eric Bieniemy.
I don't know. The expectation always, at least what it should be, is you bring the guy in and you understand that that first year is going to be a transition year and they're not going to be able to do much. But, eventually they'll turn over part of the team. They'll restock a little bit and hopefully the drafting works out well so that the coach has an opportunity to coach up some new incoming talent and they can build the team in their own image. Matt Patricia coming in and wanting to rebuild the team in his own image. That's not weird. It's just Matt Patricia's image was terrible. So,
right.
But
I will say that there is someone that I think from the same perspective might be the actual hot name. And that is the defensive coordinator for the San Francisco 49ers, Robert Saleh. He checks all the boxes, VZ. He checks every box. He is a coach that has done more with less with his defense, having so many injuries this season, as you know, JVZ.
Yep.
Also, when he had the full complement of his defensive players, they got to the Super Bowl. So not only is he able to do more with less, when he has the full complement, he raises them to the very highest level. This is a big angle here. He's from Dearborn, Michigan. He's from Dearborn. That is about as big of a story as you can ask for. The idea of a Michigan native coming to coach the Lions, that's about as good a narrative as you can hope for. I'm more sold on what Robert Saleh has done as a defensive coordinator than I am Eric Bieniemy as an offensive coordinator. However, the guy that I'm really interested in and hope gets interviewed is neither of those guys. The guy that I'm most interested in personally is the offensive coordinator for the Carolina Panthers, Joe Brady. Because here's a guy who was successful at the college level as a coach. Right now in Carolina, he is managing to have a productive offense with Teddy Bridgewater as his quarterback, who is not elite, but he's solid. And for a lot of the Panthers season, he has done it without superstar Christian McCaffrey. And my big thing for whomever the next Lions head coach is going to be is, can you scheme around lesser talent? Can you do more with less? Because there is a better than zero chance that Matthew Stafford isn't going to be here. And there's some offensive talent with the Detroit Lions, but not much. And the defense is an absolute dumpster fire. I'm hoping that's more scheme than talent, but the defense was amongst the dead-ass worst in the league. And I kind of want to see if there is someone that can do more with less. Because when you come to the Detroit Lions, that's what you're going to have to do. The Fords are loyal, and the Fords will give you every resource you need, but this is not a free agent destination because it's the Lions. You're going to have to find good talent and coach them up. The GM is going to have to know how to draft, and the coach will have to put a staff together and coach them up. That's what you're going to have to do it the old-fashioned way. And I can see that with Robert Saleh. Sorry, JVZ. And I can see that with Joe Brady. And let me be very, very clear on something, gentlemen. No matter what anybody says, and Kaz, our boy Rob Parker, actually wrote this column today, under no circumstances should it be Jim Harbaugh. Under no circumstances.
And it shouldn't be Greg Roman either. And
John Harbaugh, on the other hand, I would not say no to John Harbaugh. I would not say no to that.
Yeah. And so regarding Robert Saleh, I was surprised that he wasn't hired last year. So, you know, if he were to get hired out from under the 49ers, I would say it's probably a year overdue, because he definitely made waves last year with what he did with that team. And I think, yeah, what he's doing with all the injuries that are on the defense this year, I think is also pretty remarkable. It just seems like there's always new names that I'm hearing about that this person is having an excellent season. And it's like, I didn't even know who this guy was a year ago. And so he's definitely maximizing the talent on this team. And I feel like Kyle Shanahan also does a pretty good job of doing that on the offensive end as well. With all the injuries the 49ers have had, I'm surprised to see them kind of still in the mix somewhat for a playoff spot. But yeah, it's, by the way, if Matt Stafford is looking for a place to go, I wouldn't mind having him in San Francisco either, but
yes,
like that's a team.
First round pick for this year, next year for Matt Stafford.
No.
Okay. First and second.
We don't throw away first round picks like that.
Okay, well, we'll have to discuss this later. Okay,
but yeah,
he's still got 2 years on his contract.
But I will say, like in the NFL, drafting is important, but it's also like you can do well anywhere in the draft because you can get talent, you know, deep into the seventh round of the draft. It's not like the NBA where you've got like the top 14 picks are going to be good. And the rest, it's going to be a crapshoot whether they're even on the team within 4 years. But the NFL, you expect to get good players deep into the draft. So even if you don't have, I mean, if you're not the Lions, you expect to get good players deep into the draft. And
for the record, I am also on the Zach Wilson hype train. He is my draft quarterback draft crush. He's my guy.
All right.
Zach Wilson of BYU. Keep an eye out for him.
All right. All these. It's never great when you have to learn college player names. I mean, it's fine if you're a college football fan.
It's a part of being a Lions fan.
If your team is bad, that's when you start fixating on the lower levels of like who can come into your team next year.
Honestly, JVZ, usually after the Thanksgiving game that for some reason the league still gives the Lions after Thanksgiving, it's usually mock draft season here.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I don't know. Hopefully we can get to a point where mock draft season starts at the end of a playoff run, for the Lions. And, instead of this early in the season, but yeah, drafting is always important. You get seven new players that you can put on your team, assuming you haven't accumulated more draft picks, but it's like seven guys that you know are going to be with the team for the next 3 or 4 years that you can build into good players on cheap contracts. And missing on those picks is a killer for bad teams, and they just never get better, and they never become attractive enough that anybody good will want to come to the team. And that's just the cycle that the Lions have been in for so long. And to the point where it just seems like all of you in Michigan have just kind of gotten used to it, and
It's all we know. It's all we know.
Yeah.
We don't know what good football looks like here. We don't know what winning football looks like here. No, that does not include Barry Sanders. No, that does not include Calvin Johnson. No, that does not include Matthew Stafford, because there's never been a good team around them. We don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you could hit on one pick every once in a while, but that's not, like, football is much more of a team sport than basketball is. Like, you got to hit on the deeper picks as well. Like, you can't just hit on your first round pick. Although if you did it consistently every year, you could assemble a pretty decent team, but you got to hit on your second round picks and your third round picks and your fourth round picks too. And you're not always going to hit, but you got to hit on enough of them that you can field together a pretty good team and a team full of impact players. Okay, Matt Patricia is gone. And so that means everybody that we've talked about being on the quarterback on the head coaching hot seat for the NFL has been fired, except for Adam Gase, who is going to apparently try to run the gauntlet and go 0-16. I think that at this point, it's strategic on the Jets' part to not fire him now. Or do we have 17 games this year? Jesus. So many rules.
Isn't this the year where they added it? Isn't this the year? I think it is.
I mean, we've talked about this a bunch of times, but I'm just still confused. I don't know whether COVID kind of changed those plans or not.
The Jets are shooting for history, and it looks like they're keeping Adam Gase around so that they ensure that they have the best pick possible in the draft.
Yes. So maybe they'll get the quarterback out of BYU that you want.
Nah, I'm pretty sure they're laser focused on Trevor Lawrence. So.
Oh, that's right. All these names. Okay. Yeah. Tank for Trevor. That's right. But, you know, Trevor Lawrence sees the Jets coming. I think he should stay an extra year. Because that team has also been a long-suffering franchise. But not as notoriously as the Lions. But I'm pretty sure this year they're going to be joining the Lions and the Browns as teams that have gone 0-16 at least.
I think we're still 16 this year.
We're 16 games, but we have the seven playoff teams per conference. So they implemented like half the rules they said they were going to implement.
Right. We're back at it again. The teams that are tanking are tanking. The Giants are trying to pretend like they're still good.
They are at the top of the NFC East, Kaz.
No, they're playing pretend. They are playing pretend. They're playing house, man.
Somebody is going to win five games and win that division this year. It is going to be glorious. And they're going to get a home playoff game, and everybody's going to be mad.
Yeah,
but I mean that's part of why it's nice that they expanded the field to seven teams this year. So, so at least one team gets screwed a little bit less.
Definitely.
Yeah, the hashtag NFC Least is another story to watch this year. We haven't talked about football in a while, so nice to kind of get back into the nitty gritty of all the shenanigans. Speaking of shenanigans, Lou Williams, who very famously jeopardized the NBA bubble by going to the Magic City Strip Club, is now parlaying that into an endorsement deal. You can now buy Lou Will Lemon Pepper Wings for and get those delivered to you. Apparently $109 for a 50 pack. Good on him for at least making something out of that. He's also filed a trademark for Lemon Pepper Lou. Capitalizing on almost jeopardizing the NBA, although we know now that they probably would have found a way to work around it. It's naked wings tossed in honey barbecue sauce and sprinkled with lemon pepper seasoning, just the way NBA star Lou Williams likes them, according to their advertisement.
Oh, man.
And one last thing I want to squeeze in here, just you can look up the story, but new Mets owner Steve Cohen has the Bill Buckner ball. So that's a pretty important part of Mets history that everybody thought was kind of lost or bought by an anonymous donor by an anonymous person. And it turns out that anonymous person ended up being the person who bought the Mets, period. So So now he can stick it in their museum. So that's a fun little thing. Kind of sucks for Bill Buckner.
Imagine having an owner that actually genuinely cares about what fans have gone through and what fans have suffered through and what fans have endured.
So Steve Cohen has actually done a pretty good job of that recently since he's bought the team, of kind of endearing himself to the Mets fan base. You know, being kind of a billionaire type, I think he's not got the greatest PR history, but yeah, since he's bought the team, he's made it very clear that he started as a fan of the team, and so he's looking to approach this like a fan just as much, but that just happens to be rich. So so as long as he doesn't try to meddle too much, and keeps writing checks, then I think we might see a big market team in Major League Baseball kind of start spending money again. So look out for the Mets. And thank you all for listening to this show this week. Look out for future episodes of this show. Usually we record Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern, and you can listen live on Twitch at twitch.tv/JVZ. Head on over to sportsoddsandends.com if you want to check out our previous episodes, and with links to iTunes and Google Podcasts and other places where you can find podcasts. I'm at JVZ on Twitter. Kaz is at King Kaz. DGM is at Call Me DGM. At Sports Odds Ends is the show's Twitter account. Follow all of us for cool retweets about sports throughout the week, highlights and stuff. Yeah, thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.